This is the tax update for April the 16th, 2008. This week, was it a gift or compensation? The tax court knows. The tax update podcast intended for tax professionals is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, we've taken a little bit of a break here at the end of tax season, since I figure I've been rather busy, and I suspect many of you who are in the accounting profession have been a bit busy as well, and maybe hadn't really wanted to sit around and listening to tax podcasts. And I suspect on April 16th, that may not be your first thought either, but we need to get back in the role of things. And if you're not in tax accounting, maybe you're an attorney and you're listening to this, then maybe you're not as interested or concerned about the fact, you know, where things have been missing. So we're going to talk to you about a case that came down, and maybe one is a little bit, shall we say, more interesting set of facts than we usually see in a tax court case. And take a look at that for a little bit of unusual and different look at an issue that we're going to talk about this week, the issue of whether we have a gift or compensation for an employee. Now, the case in question we're going to look at is a case of Larson versus Commissioner, which was TC Memo 2008-73. It was decided on March 26th of 2008, and we're going to review it here this week. Now, a key starting point for the case is going to be the general rule about what is the tax treatment of transfers of wealth to a person. We know the general rule is we have a broad definition in Section 61A, and that tells us the sweeping statement that gross income means all income from whatever source derived. And then the section goes on to give us some specific list of it includes, but it's not limited to. And one of the specific items tells us that compensation for services, including fees, commissions, fringe benefits, and similar items, are one of those items that's clearly included among others. Now, as is often the case with tax provisions, we have a sweeping general rule to grab as many things in subject to tax as possible, and then we start throwing things out. And one of the things that allows us to throw things out, one of the provisions that allows us to throw things out in the tax law, is Section 102 that deals with gifts and inheritances. Now, a gift or an inheritance is clearly an accession to wealth that increases your value. So, under the general rule of Section 61, it would be income. However, Section 102A provides that gross income does not include the value of property acquired by gift, bequest, devise, or inheritance. Question becomes, what is a gift? Well, the test is one that you're not going to really find the regulations, but the courts have been pretty consistent on this test. And in fact, this today's case refers back to the Supreme Court case of Commissioner versus Duberstein, which was noted that a gift in the statutory sense proceeds from a detached and disinterested generosity. And this is quoting, that actually was the Supreme Court quoting from the decision in the LeBoux case. Out of affection, respect, admiration, charity, or like impulses, that's the Robertson case it's quoting. In this case, the court notes that the key issue is the transferor's intention. That is, if I write a check for $100,000 and hand that check to you, the question is, what's my intention in making this payment to you? Did my payment to you proceed from a detached and disinterested generosity that came out of affection, respect, admiration, charity-like impulses? Or was I expecting to get something in exchange for that? For instance, if I write a check to my employee, I expect to get, you know, the services from the employee. I expect the employee to do their work. I pay them. Maybe I pay them a bonus. That's in hope that they will in the future help, you know, on the production side, give me additional work from them, and therefore, you know, work to my benefit to get things done. I pay the guy that fixed the clogged sink. I pay him and I give him a check, not because of disinterested generosity, but because I would like my sink to drain. That is the distinction between a gift and another type of payment for income. And remember, the analysis proceeds not from the viewpoint of the recipient, who's going to be the one that will or will not pick it up in income, but rather from the person making the payment. Now, that person may still have some interest in this case because obviously if I make the payment and it's a gift, I may be subject to the gift tax under 2501 or at least reduce my ability to make gifts lifetime if that's also deemed to be a gift. And also, if in fact it meets the test of being a gift, I'm not going to be able to take a deduction under Section 162 generally for trade or business expenses. If I'm making a payment out of disinterested generosity, then it doesn't appear that I have the proper motivation to get a deduction for business purposes for this payment. Also, the Internal Revenue Code adds additional caveats for employee gifts. 102C provides in general that you shall not exclude from gross income any amount transferred by or for an employer to or for the benefit of an employee. Now, there's a specific cross-reference to employee achievement awards under 74C and certain fringe benefits under 132E. But the general rule is an employee has an even higher hurdle to clear to show if I have an employment relationship directly or indirectly with the individual who is receiving the payment from me. For instance, if I make a payment, now I currently practice in an accounting firm that's a corporation. If I make a payment to one of my employees directly out of my personal funds, that's still got to clear a hurdle. Am I making that payment for the business purpose? As is the employment relationship with the accounting firm the reason the payment's being made? And is it compensation for services? The general issue is we have a high standard to clear anyway if there appears to be a benefit. 102C goes on to make it pretty clear that as an employee, we have an even higher hurdle to clear to keep something from being considered compensation income to us. Now, these are the problems that Faith Larson was facing as she attempted unsuccessfully to exclude from her income a payment of $160,000 from her employer. Now, let's take a look because the issue is going to involve Faith and some items that took place at the end of 2000, the beginning of the year 2001. Now, Faith met Donald Hoyland, the owner of PCI, which is the corporation that's going to be in play in this case, in 1998. Faith was hired as Mr. Hoyland's executive assistant at PCI in July of 1999 at a salary of $60,000 per year. After she'd been there 1 year, she was promoted to vice president and her salary was increased by 50% to $90,000 a year. So this puts us into approximately summer of 2000. As vice president, Faith interacted with a number of different departments within PCI and provided Mr. Hoyland with suggestions regarding the operation of PCI. When Mr. Hoyland retired in December of 2000, Ms. Larson was promoted to be the president of PCI. During this period, the court made the following observations on the nature of the relationships between Mr. Hoyland and Ms. Larson. The court noted that the interaction between the petitioner and Mr. Hoyland were typically professional. The petitioner often spoke with Mr. Hoyland by phone as she drove to work. The two had lunch together regularly before Mr. Hoyland retired. Their relationship was never intimate. However, it appeared that Ms. Larson might not want to be the long-term president of PCI, and that led to a series of incidents that gave rise to the payment in question, or at least led them in the court's view to those payments. Ms. Larson, as is going to become clear, came to a different conclusion about the reason why these actions took place as the situation moved forward. The court noted that Ms. Larson refused to sign an employment contract of more than 1 year because she wasn't certain how long she would stay in the Seattle area, and she could only be president of PCI if she stayed in Seattle. This led to a series of increasing offers to Ms. Larson to keep her and have her commit to staying beyond 1 year. The offers included a $20,000 raise, a Jaguar automobile, and even her own condominium. Despite these increasing inducements to stay in Seattle, Ms. Larson turned them down and refused to commit to more than the 1 year contract. Now we get to the $160,000 question. In January of 2001, Ms. Larson received a $160,000 payment from PCI, placing those funds into a bank account she had created to start a commercial photography business. She was assisted in setting up this new business by PCI's accountant, David Scone. Mr. Scone ends up coming back into this a few times and get a little sympathetic for them because I begin to believe, reading between the lines, that he may be caught in the middle of all this. Ms. Larson's attorney contacted Mr. Scone about receiving this payment. Now, she and her attorney allege that Mr. Schoen characterized the payment as a gift, but neither one of them asked for documentation the amount was a gift. And later on, after some incidents we're going to talk about, because remember, this would have been issued in January of 2002, PCI issued Ms. Larson a 1099 miscellaneous for this $160,000 payment. The court also noted a factor that would be that she would feel was important in this case, that she and Mr. Hoyland had discussed bonuses at Christmas time a few weeks before PCI paid her the $160,000. It was, she indicated that it was her belief that no other employee of PCI received a bonus as large as $160,000 that she received. Well, at that point, things appeared to be looking up for Ms. Larson. She had just gotten a $160,000 check. She was employed by a company that appeared to really want her to be there. And as long as she wanted to stay in Seattle, it looked like she was fine. She was going to be president of PCI. But things were going to change rather dramatically later that year that would give rise to her claim that the payment was intended to something that wasn't necessarily related to her employment status, but was rather the expensive equivalent of a potential romantic interest sending unsolicited gifts to the person that they want to get the attention of. As we noted, Mr. Hoyland had retired from PCI and left the operations to Ms. Larson. Mr. Hoyland, with this extra time on his hands, began to travel. And during one trip, the following incident occurred that would become crucial in a lot of ways going forward. While traveling, Mr. Hoyland called Petitioner and threatened to fire her if she did not sleep with him when he returned. Petitioner feared that Mr. Hoyland, a recovering alcoholic, was drinking again, and she attributed his advances to a relapse. The petitioner called the personnel manager for PCI, who encouraged her to prepare and file a summary of her conversation with Mr. Hoyland. Apparently, she did so. Mr. Hoyland apologized to the petitioner when he returned from his vacation and explained that he had indeed been drinking. However, things didn't go well from this point forward. Things began to turn downhill for Ms. Larson in her relationship with PCI. The court noted that her relationship with Mr. Hoyland and PCI deteriorated rapidly after this exchange with Mr. Hoyland. And indeed, in September of 2001, Mr. Hoyland fired Ms. Larson as president of PCI. As you might suspect, this firing led to Ms. Larson asserting a claim against PCI for damages after her employment was terminated. The parties engaged in mediation to settle this claim. The court noted that petitioner, through her counsel, alleged that the $160,000 payment was a bonus during the mediation. The mediation resulted in the petitioner receiving a $100,000 settlement, of which $25,000 was allocated to back wages and $75,000 to general damages, attorneys, and fees and costs. So basically, she got her $25,000 and $75,000 went to damages, attorney fees, cost, all those sorts of things. The petitioner and PCI waived all of their claims against one another as part of the mediation agreement. And the tax treatment of the mediation settlement was not in dispute between her and the IRS, meaning that she reported that as income. But the question for tax purposes became, what was the nature of that $160,000 that Ms. Larson had received back in January? Now, on her 2001 tax return is the one in issue because she got this payment in January of 2001. She had her attorney, Mr. Pettigrew, prepare her 2001 income tax returns. She provided Mr. Pettigrew with that 1099 miscellaneous that reported both the $260,000 payment and a computer she received whose value was set on the 1099 at $2,662.71. Now, she and the IRS agreed the actual value of that computer was closer to $400, and that's what she needed to pay tax on. But the $160,000 was not reported as income on her return. And she took the position, at least to her, it was clear that her payment resulted from an unrequited romantic interest in her. And she felt she was strengthened in this fact by the fact that she was the only employee to receive such a generous bonus. Now, the court noted that Mr. Pettigrew, the attorney preparing her return, did not ask for any additional information from PCI to confirm the $160,000 payment was a gift, and made no independent determination of whether the payment was a bonus or gift. He accepted her characterization that this was a gift. Ms. Larson had not severed her connection with everybody at PCI, it turns out. Remember Mr. Schoen helped her set up her business, her photography business? Well, he assisted her in filing her state tax returns, and it would appear that this was a business and occupations tax return with the state of Washington. The court doesn't say so for sure, but it's clearly with the state of Washington. On that return, she reported the Mr. Schoen reported that $160,000 payment to Ms. Larson in the category of services and other activities, basically as income under the photography business, for which the business and occupations tax in Washington would apply. Now, PCI did not deduct the $160,000 payment on its return, and it issued a 1099 miscellaneous rather than a W-2 for its payment to Ms. Larson. Now, while the court doesn't comment on that fact, the experience for many of us would suggest that the mere fact that a payment of that size to an employee was not reported on a W-2 but turned out on a 1099 indicates that at the time it was paid, well, I don't know what we're planning to do with it, but apparently we decided it wasn't for the services she had performed as an employee. And that we weren't going to put it in W-2 because obviously we had no withholding. We get to the end of the year. Now we decide, oh, maybe it is taxable to her. And now it's not in our W-2. We don't want to admit we screwed up the withholdings. So what we'll do is we'll just issue a 1099 miscellaneous for this payment. As well, Mr. Schoen's position appears to be somewhat interesting. Being involved in that original transaction, it appears likely he knew that taxes were not being withheld and it was not being treated as wages paid to her. As well, it seems likely he was aware the payment was being reported on a 1099 miscellaneous and that he had input on the corporate tax return where the amount was not deducted. If he was involved in all of these transactions, and that certainly appears very possible, it appears he wasn't sure what exactly the proper treatment was, except he knew that these other people had created a mess from a tax perspective, that where nothing was clear, and he wasn't about to take on their mess and referee it. So he was just going to say a pox on all your houses and go in the government's favor everywhere he could. And that's essentially what happened in this case, because if you think about the background, PCI never claimed a deduction for paying the 160. That's noted as a fact in the case. Ms. Larson paid tax on it, so everybody got to pay tax on this 160. Now we have to take a look at what did the court decide had really happened here. Why were the amounts paid? And there the key question becomes, why did Mr. Hoyland and PCI make these payments to Ms. Larson? Now, the tax court outlined some key factors in the following portion of its decision. It noted that Mr. Hoyland rewarded her performance as an officer and employee of PCI with promotion and raises. He arranged to give her a $160,000 payment after she turned down that raise, the offer of the home and automobile. The offers that preceded the $160,000 payment related to her role as an employee. These offers were either to reward her performance or to induce her to remain in the Seattle area. The court goes on to note that although the petitioner and Mr. Hoyland worked together and were close acquaintances, there was no romantic relationship between them. Petitioner did not travel with Mr. Hoyland. Their social relationship did not transcend their work relationship. Although he made one sexual advance, she flatly rejected it. Those facts suggest the $160,000 payment was motivated by the business reasons and not by detached or disinterested generosity. And remember, that's the key test for us on whether it was a gift. Considering the record as a whole, the court notes, we find that the petitioner's uncorroborated testimony that Mr. Hoyland had an unrequited romantic interest in her or that she was the only employee to receive a substantial payment at the end of the year is insufficient to support a contention that the payment was a gift. We are not required to accept the self-serving testimony of interested parties without persuasive evidence or corroboration. The court appears to be making it clear that the issue is not whether Ms. Larson believes the payment was for something other than her services as an employee, but rather whether there is evidence that Mr. Hoyland and PCI meant for that was their motivation at the time the payment was made. A real problem we seem to have with the facts of the case, looking at it from the court's view, is she didn't appear to be able to come up with anything prior to the payment of the 160, or even sometime after that, that indicated that this payment was somehow contingent upon or somehow was not related to her performance as an employee. In fact, her rapid rejection of the one sexual advance that he made suggests that if she had believed that had been true, she would have been very clear in her rejection and would have, in fact, probably, it would seem, have considered turning it down entirely or refusing it. She had already refused $20,000, the cars, other things. So it does not appear that she believed it was tied to, basically, an agreement with him on his unrequited romantic interest. Now, the court found, therefore, that she had to pick that back up. As well, Mr. Schoen comes back to haunt Ms. Larson. Her attorney claimed that Mr. Skoda indicated the payment was a gift back when it was paid. And that seems to be the only direct evidence that we had from somebody other than her and her attorney, if we believe he made that statement, that the payment was intended to be a gift. However, the court noted PCI's issuance of a 1099 miscellaneous for $160,000 of payment indicates that PCI did not intend this payment to be a gift. Petitioner reported that $160,000 payment as income under the category services and other activity on her state tax return and paid the state tax and additional income. Mr. Scone, the same accountant who purportedly advised Mr. Pettigrew that the payment was a gift, prepared that return. As well, the court found Ms. Larson was liable for the accuracy-related penalty under 6662A. The court did not find a reasonable basis for her position the payments were not taxable, noting, petitioner claims she relied on Mr. Hoyland and Mr. Sclone's characterization of the payment. She presents no credible evidence corroborating her testimony that this was indeed their characterization of the payment. She also presents no credible evidence that Mr. Hoyland or Mr. Scone was competent to advise her on the taxable nature of the payment she received. Petitioners claim that Mr. Scone told her the payment was a gift are even harder to believe because Mr. Scone prepared her state tax return reporting the payment as income. She also could not get out of the penalty by claiming she relied on the advice of her attorney. Remember, the attorney had prepared the tax return for her. The court noted a couple of problems with that defense. Petitioner also claims to have relied upon the advice of Mr. Pettigrew. This is dubious as he offered none. He relied on her characterization of the payment as a gift and made no further inquiry. Particularly troubling is the fact that he completely disregarded the Form 1099 miscellaneous from PCI that the petitioner provided to him. It would appear the court wasn't happy with Ms. Larson, nor was the court terribly thrilled with the attorney just ignoring that 1099 miss and not doing anything moving forward. The court would appear to believe that it wasn't reasonable for her to rely on him. They don't believe he actually ever opined on this factor, which suggests that, reading again between the lines, that he was not willing to testify at court that he had given her such advice. And as well, it would suggest that Mr. Scone wasn't willing to testify that he had said it was a gift. So in both cases, she didn't have anybody to get up there to help her out of either of these situations. Now, why was the court so harsh? Well, the court doesn't mention it, but it seems to me likely that the inconsistent position on the nature of $160,000 payment she took when she was negotiating the settlement of her claim against PCI most likely weighed heavily in this decision. In that dispute, treating that as compensation for the excellent work she had done previously really helped bolster her claim that, you know what, it was simply the fact that I turned down Mr. Hoyland's sexual advance that got me fired. I clearly am a valuable, useful employee. I am worth being paid $90,000 plus $160,000 bonus. I did $250,000 worth of value to the firm last year. I'm worth $250,000. They've now fired me, claimed I didn't do adequate performance. That's going to hurt me in the future. I deserve to be paid and paid for my damages and paid for, you know, the damage they did to me and my reputation. That position, while treating that as a bonus, paid for her services, was very useful for her probably in negotiating out the mediation agreement because it would have seemed a case that maybe you didn't want to, as the employer, end up taking to court and trying to argue why that payment was made if it wasn't related to any, you know, if she really didn't have the adequate performance, especially since you had now issued a 1099 miscellaneous to her at the end of the day by the time this was done. It may be a problem that she had then when she went to tax court. Now she was claiming the opposite. Oh, no, that clearly had nothing to do with my performance as an employee. Court wasn't going to buy that. So what it means is we have to consider these issues of what is and what is not a gift. In many cases, we have clients that want to treat things as gifts or want to have payments made to people, including employees, treated as gifts. We need to be very aware that that is a very difficult position to take, no matter how you look at it, and that, in fact, these particular cases are usually very, very difficult. Employment relationships tend to make it into taxable compensation. And the other side of the equation, we may have some issues there, is whether it was an ordinary necessary and whether it was reasonable compensation. But from the employee's side, we almost never have a problem with the fact that it's going to be taxable compensation. Finally, to close out this week, I wanted to bring in something here totally unrelated, but kind of interesting that I ran across on the web during the end of tax season. And it's coming from a source that you probably wouldn't usually go look at, so I thought I'd mention it here because I found it to be a very interesting one that you might want to listen to. I picked up a podcast that I listen to. As many of you may be aware, I currently record these podcasts on a MacBook that is, you know, an Apple-based PC. I run Parallels on that PC, so when I need Windows programs, I bring those up through that. But basically, I usually run on the Macintosh, and I do a lot of computer work and do that kind of thing in the background, kind of as a hobby. So I listen to a podcast called Mac Break Tech, which deals with very geeky topics, shall we say, involving Macintosh computers. Now, that's probably not an item of interest to most of the people listening to this podcast, who overwhelmingly most likely are running Windows machines, and also don't really want to get in deep into the technology of the computer anyway. But they had a very interesting podcast on their April 8th edition that I think has of interest far beyond those who are in the Macintosh community. In that particular podcast, all of the participants, and it's a discussion forum that they have, so there's a group of them that get together and discuss matters, they all operate their own small service businesses, and their April 8th podcast was titled Making Mac Your Business, deals not so much with starting a business based on a Macintosh, that's dealt with very briefly, but very quickly, and rather deals with a real-world discussion of the problems business people in the service business have about getting the businesses running, keeping them running, things like getting paid, why it's not quite as simple as appeared to someone working for a large entity to go it alone and have everything happen, why maybe you don't want to quit your day job if you're doing that, and all the other neat issues that we deal with. They talk about the importance of concentrating on your specialty and being able to use and pay for services of others to take care of those things that aren't your specialty. Now, I should note that one particular participant got a little bit edgy when the question came up about paying an attorney up front, you know, to get your partnership agreements and those things put together. And he was suggesting, of course, not using that because attorneys are going to charge you too much, was his theory. I will note that it seems pretty clear that one of the other participants wasn't so thrilled with that position necessarily. And in fact, kind of comes out and, you know, doesn't get too bad, and they work around that issue. But the general discussion here is very useful, I think, for those of us who are in a service business to look at, include such nice issues about getting paid, the problem of lowballing your fees to get a job and then never being able to get the fees back up after that. And that's something I think both accountants and attorneys have run into, where we've come into something and agreed to do it for a price was totally unreasonable, and then they got stuck with problems or never been able to get the client to come back up to a reasonable level. And those are all interesting discussion points, the importance of getting paid, all those neat little things. It's a very good listen. The webcast is, or I should say the podcast is in the April 8th edition. Their website is MacBreakTech, that's all one word, .com. And if you go to the April 8th link, you're going to find the link to the podcast. As well, in the audio file, or in the text file that I have that you can get on the website, you go there and you'll get the link to the text that I'll have uploaded to my website for this particular podcast. I also have the link directly to their full MP3 file. Now, we can even forgive them for the fact that at one point they discussing an accountant thinking of starting a business, and they decide that, well, it seems difficult for them to imagine that accountants could have dreams and vision. But we hopefully, those of us who are accountants, can have some dreams and vision, and hopefully they'll accept for that. But I found it a very useful podcast to listen to and to consider the issues of what happens to a small business. Now, this has been the Tax Update Podcast for April 16th, 2008. As always, the Tax Update Podcast is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services has all kinds of interesting materials for those of us in tax practice. Be sure to visit them on the web. This has been the Tax Update Podcast.